Hello, I'm Scott Winship, Executive Director of the Joint Economic Committee, the Director of the JEC's Social Capital Project, and this is the Social Capitalist Podcast. On the podcast, we invite our hearing witnesses to join JEC staff in a post-hearing discussion so we can get a little more in the weeds, dive more deeply into the issues we're covering during the hearing, hopefully have a little bit of fun along the way. We just finished our first hearing on expanding opportunity by strengthening families, communities, and civil society. You can read our witnesses' opening statements and watch the full hearing on our website, as well as read our new paper titled The Wealth of Relations, which touched on many of the same issues discussed during the hearing. And today on our inaugural podcast, I'm excited to be joined by Dr. Ryan Streeter, Director of Domestic Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, and Patrick Sharkey, who's a professor of sociology at New York University. Thank you both for agreeing to be on the podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Thanks, Scott.
Well, this is our inaugural podcast, so we'll see how things go. This will determine the content and the format of all future podcasts to come, so no pressure on anybody at this point. That's right. Why don't we just start off by if you could sort of give just an informal summary of what you talked about in your testimony, how you think about social capital and opportunity. Ryan, you want to go ahead and start?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Scott. I talked a little bit in my remarks about some of the data that we have from a survey that we just recently published on social capital and civic well-being, and focused specifically on differences between people that are highly civic and people who are highly social, people that are both or people that are neither. We use questions like you would expect in our survey. You know, how many organizations are you actively involved in that you volunteer in or that you're a member of? And we grouped people by people who were in more than two, people that were in one or two, or people that were less than one or less. And then we also looked at creating a sociability scale, just how many friends and family members, neighbors do you talk to every week? What kind of ways do you interact with them? And just looked at how these things played out through other questions that we asked. Basically, we found that when people are both civically engaged and very social, they're happier, they're more committed to their communities. But what really emerged in our data is people who are civic, even if they're not social, generally tend to have stronger attachments to their communities. What shows up interestingly in our data is that being civic, being engaged in your community, creates attachments that just having a lot of friends and hanging out with them, at the cafe down the street doesn't necessarily achieve. Is that all Americans? No, that's about a third of us. About a third of us are joiners. I don't think we all have to be joiners for America's civic life to work very well. But what I used those data points to suggest is that remembering that there are people willing to invest in their communities who want to be engaged, they find fulfillment in doing that, and communities are better as a result of it, is something that we should think about in policy. And so the second half of my remarks were really focused on just kind of revisiting the past. We went through this kind of weird season, interesting season in the early 1990s, where we had major domestic policy reforms, from school reform to policing reform to welfare reform to housing reform, that when you go back and you look at the deliberations that led up to those policies, the idea that there are these fundamental units of civil society, of community that are really important, were actually factored into the policy design. It doesn't mean all of those policies were an overwhelming success in every way. Some of them were more successful than have previously been reported. We know that because of people like you, Scott, who've written about welfare reforms effects and the like.
This is why I invited Ryan onto the show.
Yeah, that's right. And what I am suggesting is that for some reason, and we can kind of theorize why, we've gotten away from that in the last 10 years or so. Maybe we can talk about that later. But this notion that communities, families, neighborhoods should be central in our domestic policy design has largely been absent from our policymaking discourse over the last 10 years or so.
Excellent. Definitely want to come back to that point as well. Pat, could you explain for our vast millions of listeners what you discussed today in the hearing, which was attended also by thousands, I should say. If you missed it, it's really unclear why you were not there, but you did miss some incredible remarks by Pat. Tell us about your testimony and your broader research.
Yeah, sure. Well, first off, I should say that the last thing that Ryan just said about developing policy that recognizes that we're not just trying to provide resources or benefits to individuals walking through the world isolated from everyone else, that's crucial. I do think that social policy often forgets that people are embedded within communities and within networks that extend across different realms of their lives. And if we had that in mind when we developed social policy, then we have a much better chance of building stronger communities. So that was really my focus in my comments. How can we build stronger communities? And I think some of the the context there that we have to keep in mind is that there are good reasons to worry about our community lives. Neighborhood inequality is severe. There are ways in which it is growing. So the degree to which the poor live apart from the rich has been growing since the 1970s. Neighborhood inequality is multi-generational. It affects parents and then is transmitted to the next generation with consequences across generations. And then there's also a new form of inequality, inequality between cities and regions, where we have some parts of the country where that are thriving, you know, where wages are rising, where there is strong economic growth, and other parts of the country that have been left out, where opportunities are scarce, where people really feel isolated from economic opportunity. And so the kind of challenge that I framed in the hearing is, how do we respond to this? How do we respond to these new challenges that are facing America's communities? And, you know, there are different ways to approach these problems. You can focus on mobility, moving people to new places that offer greater opportunities. You can focus on kind of just breaking down the barriers that are in place in cities and towns across the country, that like exclusionary zoning policies that limit the opportunities for people to move wherever they choose, wherever is the best place for the family and their children. But then there's also a set of policies that focus on investment. How can we invest in communities so that every neighborhood across the country has that core set of institutions, schools, libraries, community centers that really prop up a community, that provide the foundation for community life? And that's really what I focused on.
Great. Ryan, let's go back to your point. I think it's fair to say everybody, when they think about the 1990s, they think of three things. They think of flannel, they think of Coolio, and they think of the social capital-based policy innovations of the 1990s. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, maybe Pearl Jam.
Sure, right. Yeah. Exactly. We can.
That goes with the flannel, though.
Yeah, sure.
Alanis Morissette, perhaps. Why is it that we left all of this grunge, everything? Why did we leave specifically policies that had this grounding in social capital behind in the 90s? What happened between then and now?
I'm not entirely sure. The 90s have been described as a vacation from history. So maybe that was just part of the deal. You know, all kinds of good things were happening in the 90s. A good economy, no really big wars after the Gulf War, et cetera. I think more seriously, there is something about the post-9/11 environment that did change some things. I mean, we entered a new era, and our domestic policymaking and our foreign policymaking were really sort of separated from one another in a way that they hadn't been during the Cold War, when they were linked by some common themes and the like. And domestic policy was kind of dealing with some new challenges from the Bush years through the Obama years. You had some big things that were taken on, whether it was deciding to figure out a national role for education reform, expanding Medicare for seniors by adding prescription drugs, then the ACA and Obamacare. And the discussions were all these big kind of national discussions. That still doesn't answer why we moved away. I mean, you could still very much envision a scenario within which that didn't happen. Probably some of it had to do with the Bush administration's attempt to focus on faith-based and community organizations and sort of nationalizing that approach too. In some people's minds, a lot of Republicans didn't like that, started not talking those ways. And then you had this kind of Republican backlash to the early kind of Obama decisions on the stimulus and on Obamacare and those sorts of things that led to the Tea Party movement. And when you look at, and I do this a little bit in a separate essay I wrote, National Affairs in the spring issue, looking at kind of the rhetoric of the Tea Party versus the rhetoric of, say, the Republicans of 94, it's really different. There was the contract with America that, you know, Newt Gingrich and others led, but there was this contract from America, now I forget the name of it, that the Tea Party didn't, much less sort of known, but crowdsourced. Funny thing is, it was kind of crowdsourced in a very grassroots way, but the idea that communities are really a part of the solution to our biggest problems is totally absent from the rhetoric. And I think you've seen Democrats just moving farther away from this as well, where we've tended to, probably for a variety of reasons, maybe the internet and social media in their kind of evolved state have contributed to this. We know that we stay within cocoons ideologically now, and because of changes in the way that news is consumed and who's delivering it, we generally tend to be obsessed with national issues. It just is where cable news is, it's where talk radio is, it's, you know, focusing on national issues is sort of has become the big thing on both the right and the left. I think it's, you know, I don't even think I've answered your question. I think I've just rambled and described some phenomena that hopefully could be pieced together to something like an answer. But I have been you know, encouraged over the last couple of years. There seems to be kind of a renewed interest, in part because of what you guys are doing here at the Social Capital Project, but I think also just because of the exhaustion with our national politics, there has been kind of a renewed interest, both on the right and the left, in kind of revisiting themes of subsidiarity and federalism, the integrity and sovereignty of local municipalities and those sorts of things, and their role in solving public policy problems. So I think we're at a good time to capitalize on that.
Excellent. We'll come back and talk about some of your other research on localism in a second. Pat, one of the things that I think we didn't get to hear about your work during the hearing, but which is certainly relevant to the topic, and I know you've done great work on, is your research around violence and its impact on kids and communities. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, sure. Well, I started working on violence. Basically, I initially was studying urban inequality generally, and then the more evidence I looked at, the more I started to think that violence is really the crucial ingredient, the crucial mechanism which makes neighborhood inequality, or at least one of the primary reasons why neighborhood disadvantage in particular is so damaging, has such long-lasting consequences. So it was really the data that led me to focus on violence. And then the more work I did, the more severe the consequences of community violence looked. So violence, you know, has a direct effect on victims and perpetrators, but it also extends across entire communities. And when communities become violent, families are less likely to invest in a neighborhood and want to raise kids there. But it's also businesses that are less likely to open up shop, and teachers are less likely to commit to a school district. People are less willing to venture out into public space to use public amenities like parks and playgrounds and so forth. So I just have started to see violence as really the fundamental challenge of cities. Now, the good news is violence has plummeted. So across the country, the level of violence has fallen by roughly half since the early 1990s. And in a bunch of major cities, D.C. being one of them, but New York, L.A., San Diego, the city has completely transformed as violence has fallen by 75%, 80%, 90% in New York. And so my research is really looking at how has this just transformative change affected urban inequality, and particularly urban poverty, the experience of urban poverty. And the quick finding, you still have to go purchase the book, but the quick finding is that it has just had a transformative effect, and the greatest benefits have gone to the most disadvantaged segments of the population. The question that remains is, how do we continue to reduce violence, but do so in a different way, do so in a way that does not rely heavily on the police and the prison as a primary mechanism to respond to violent crime, do so in a way that really invests in community organizations that we know have tremendous capacity to control violence and to kind of provide informal social controls over public space, but that just have never been given that same commitment.
Yeah, we recently put together a social capital index, and one of the components of that index was essentially the violent crime rate. And our thinking was it's an indicator of, I think, what sociologists call collective efficacy. You've mm-hmm. certainly been one of the pioneers on that. But the point you raise now, I think, is something that we hadn't thought as much about, which is that places that have a lot of crime, it does redound to the other institutions in a community, and it can have these kind of self-reinforcing downward spiral qualities. So that's certainly a hopeful story that crime is going down, and see how that goes. You don't put much credence into the sort of bump that some places have experienced in crime recently.
Well, in those places, it's a huge issue, but most of them, it hasn't persisted. So Baltimore is a huge concern, but Chicago violence skyrocketed up for 2 years and then fell just as quickly and is almost back to where it was before the spike. So we need to maintain urgency, but there hasn't been any kind of large-scale change. And so just very quickly, the good part about this is that violence makes everything else impossible. So when it starts to fall, when it goes away, it makes lots of other stuff possible. It makes it possible to think about communities that can transform and revitalize. And I think that's where we are in a bunch of cities. There's really great potential to invest in cities right at this moment because they're finally safe places.
Mm. And I think people have forgotten just how much crime there used to be. John Singleton died yesterday at 51, which is awful. But it instantly made me go back to Boys in the Hood, which was a sort of a formative movie for me as a kid growing up in Maine.
It was very relatable and a descriptive exercise, basically, for people who had lived in and around cities during that time.
Yes, it really, you look back at it, and it was a time where like gang violence was probably over magnified into this pervasive thing. But But it really is quite different these days when you, especially in Washington, D.C., you walk through neighborhoods that 15 years ago were not safe places and today are now home to yuppies and folks of all sorts of different backgrounds. It really is remarkable. Ryan, you've also, I know, spent a lot of your time at AEI trying to get more people thinking creatively about localism, the benefits of localism, what public policies can do to promote localism. What are the benefits of localism? Why ought policymakers, why should they be thinking about ways to empower lower levels of government versus focusing on federal programs?
Yeah, and clarification at the outset, I'm not trying to get people to think creatively about localism. I'm just trying to get people to think about localism. It's just, you know, for starters, that would be a small victory. No, I think that there's no kind of prefabricated view of federalism here at work at AEI. It's just when we deal with domestic policy design and policy research, it just becomes clear that, you know, so many of these problems that we talk about, again, international politics and national forums, it's really hard to solve this stuff if you don't actually have some kind of regional and local strategy. And that goes for education policy. It goes for criminal justice reform, reentering people that are reentering from incarceration, and to workforce development, which I think is a frontier that we really haven't kind of subjected to the same kind of reform-minded work. It's very difficult to attack these problems of inequality where they exist without thinking about these things regionally. It's I have yet to find a sort of a national federal solution that would actually do what a lot of advocates for them say they do. Not to say those aren't bad policy ideas for what they can achieve, but in terms of really addressing some of these problems of sustained lack of access to upward mobility, I think you need to actually think about the role of local institutions or you just won't succeed. More kind of fundamentally, kind of almost at the anthropological level, I think there's just a lot of evidence that we are localists just by nature. I mean, we, you know, it can be a bad thing. Our tribalism, when it is exclusionary and you got a little bit too much bonding social capital and not enough bridging social capital, you can actually reinforce bigotry. You can reinforce exclusionary thinking and all of these things that our nation has struggled with from the very beginning. But also at the same time, you can't deny the reality that people identify with where they're from. And they care about where they're from. And so involving them on the basis of that care is actually a pretty good thing. And we see this in the survey that I referenced earlier. We saw this in several different interesting ways. When you ask people where they get a strong sense of community from, or some sense of community, you find that people are, you know, they get a very strong sense of community where the city that they're from and the neighborhood where they live, more than their political ideology or their ethnic background. And so we hear a lot about identity politics today, and it's a thing and all of that. But when you ask people, you know, where's your sense of community, they're like, where I live. You know, I'm defensive of my hometown. If I can poke fun at my hometown, but if other people do it, I get defensive for some reason. Just like we get defensive if someone makes fun of our names, even though we didn't actually choose our names. Most of us didn't. There's this attachment, you know, that's kind of a real thing. It's not just our survey. This has been true in other survey data that you know, people are much more confident in their local institutions of government than they are state and federal governments. That trust has been declining now for decades. The confidence in local institutions has remained consistently high at roughly the same levels. Is that because local governments are less prone to graft and, you know, that they don't have transparency problems? Of course not. You know, some of the best examples of the weirdest kind of corruption are in local governments. There's just something about the proximity that you believe that you can actually have an effect on what's going on in your local community. So I think the benefits of strong communities are clear, and Pat's talked about that, written about that at length, talked about that eloquently in the hearing today. If those things are true, and they are, then it really doesn't make sense for us to think about public policy making without including them. So that's really what's kind of driving my emphasis on localism right now, just because a lot of our so-called national problems in domestic policy really can't be addressed if you don't have an approach that really involves communities and has them investing back in their neighborhoods.
Completely agree. Do one more round of questions, maybe. So, Pat, based on your research, can you tell us what happens to social capital when there's an economic downturn or loss of jobs in a neighborhood?
Well, my sense is that it's a combination of an economic downturn and loss of jobs combined with the local infrastructure. And by that, I mean, actually, a colleague at NYU, Eric Kleinenberg, has used this term social infrastructure to describe the set of local institutions and places, really, that bring people together, that try to integrate people into the community. And it's really, you know, the consequences of a downturn, the consequences of job loss become much more severe if we don't have that set of institutions, which could be reentry programs, job training programs, you know, child care centers, social service providers that allow people to have support, transportation support, wage subsidies, to get them back on their feet, to get them back into the labor force, or at least get them moving toward that goal. So I really see it as a combination. It's job loss is one thing, and I certainly don't want to downplay the consequences of large-scale job loss, but it is exacerbated, and it starts to tear apart the fabric of communities when you don't have those core institutions in place.
Hey, can I just say something about
Please.
That, too, just in terms of social infrastructure thought of as sort of just basic amenities and the like. We've got a report coming out in a couple of weeks, which we'll dig down into this in greater detail. We've written about this a little bit. We found across municipality types, large cities, suburbs, small towns, when people are within a walking distance or short drive from a certain collection of these amenities or institutions, schools, libraries are really important to Americans. You mentioned this earlier today, Pat, in your remarks, but people still in this digital age, people still really value libraries as community institutions. The kind of amenities that people think about in neighborhoods, from access to grocery stores, which are really important to people, and bars and restaurants and gyms and all these things. We asked about all of these things, and we found that it's amazingly consistent across municipality type. When people live within a proximate distance to a large collection of these things, whether it's a small town or a big city, they are more involved in their community, they're less lonely, they're happier. There's something really important about the way our communities are designed. And so when people live just within a close range of one or two, but really are not close to other things, and you think about this particularly in terms of food deserts or parts of, you know, communities where people are just living in these tracts of land with dilapidated housing and not access to institutions that people care about, it has a real effect. It has all kinds of rippling effects. And so we were surprised by how pronounced this effect was. So I think, if anything, I hope that what we do will generate more interest in kind of researching some of these questions.
Well, the most important thing that I heard in the hearing today, I think, was that if I live in a neighborhood that has a lot of gyms, that I will be happier even if I do not use the gym.
Even if you don't go. Yeah, just knowing a gym is close by seems to matter for people, even if they don't actually go there.
And the not using the gym is the key part of that one for me. So thank you for that information.
However we can help.
I think it's time for us to end. I did want to sort of end on by highlighting finding that Pat has had for, I don't know, this probably goes back not quite a decade at this point, I don't think. Pat's been studying economic mobility for a while. Our paths have intersected at various points, and Pat wrote a report for us at the Pew Charitable Trusts when I was there about black-white differences in mobility. And probably one of the most striking findings that I've ever seen in social science, I think, came from Pat's work. He had put together some results that looked at people who were born in the late 1950s, early 1960s, and essentially was looking at concentrated poverty differences between blacks and whites. And he gave us this really depressing chart that showed essentially, this isn't going to be quite right, but essentially that about 6% of white kids had experienced over the course of their childhood a level of neighborhood poverty that about two-thirds of black kids had experienced, of high neighborhood poverty. And so that was pretty shocking to me. And I don't come to this stuff without any kind of background. And I thought about it, I was like, well, you know, maybe these folks, they were born like right on the cusp of sort of the civil rights movement achieving some of its major victories. You know, maybe that wouldn't be as bad for kids born more recently. And then we thought about it and we realized there was a data set of kids that were born in the early 1980s. And Pat went back and took a look at that. And lo and behold, the chart that came back, you know, it's almost looking like a carbon copy of the first generation, that essentially nothing had changed over this 20, 25 year period. And I think that's just a crucial finding, that even kind of when you think you're comparing whites and African-Americans who have sort of experienced, you know, their own childhood poverty, even if that's the case, they've not experienced concentrated neighborhood poverty that really is sort of a unique barrier, I think, to African-American kids. Hopefully we're going to continue looking into those sorts of inequalities on the project. Sorry to paraphrase your own research.
No, that was a really nice plug. Thank you.
I'm very eloquent. No, it's just always been one of those findings that has stuck with me. I mean, that's in Pat's book, Stuck in Place,
I believe. Stuck in Place.
Well, thank you both for your time this afternoon. I know these hearings can be exhausting. You guys actually sat through two rounds of questions, which I've not seen before. You're both still standing. Hopefully we can keep you engaged in the project and keep you involved in future work that we do. But thanks again to Ryan Streeter and Pat Sharkey. Thanks to you all for listening, and we will be back with our next hearing, hopefully in a month or so. Thanks for listening.